We're looking at the Dharma through stories and symbols. That's the sort of overall structure of what we've been doing for the past few months. And what the structure we're using just at the moment is we're using what's called Sangharakshita's system of meditation or system of spiritual development. Integration, bringing the sort of different parts of ourselves together, creating a unified human being out of the different sort of forces in ourselves, positive emotion, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. So that's, he first of all sort of put that forward as a system of meditation, but it's also a system of, if you like, of spiritual development. So we've looked at integration. We've looked at how we need to create harmony among the sort of different parts of ourselves, if you like, get all our energies pulling in the same direction, be able to focus ourselves. And we've looked at, we spent quite a lot of time looking at positive emotion as well. So we've seen why developing positive emotion is a completely essential part of developing on the Buddhist path. For one thing, because we can't see clearly except when we're in a positive emotional state. We do not see the world clearly when we're in a negative state. We see it through the lenses of our negative emotions. And secondly, because enlightenment, which is the goal of Buddhism, is just as much about transforming the emotions as it is about some sort of insight, about seeing truth. The two just absolutely go together. You can't separate them. So we've spent quite a lot of time looking at positive emotion. And now we're looking at spiritual death. So week before last, last week was a bit of a special week, but the week before last, we looked at a symbol that links positive emotion, if you like, with spiritual death, which is the symbol of the Dakini, or the sky dancer, from the sort of late Indian and Tibetan tradition. The sky dancer, who represents, among other things, the sort of joy, the absolute uninhibited emotional bliss of liberating ourselves, stepping out of the boring safety of our old self and our old life, and stop trudging through the sort of corridors of our past and launching ourselves into the sky of something completely new and different, becoming a different person, leaving the old self behind. So we're going to continue on that theme today. We're going to continue on the theme of spiritual death. But bring it a bit more down to earth from the sky dancer dancing up there in the sort of clear blue sky. So I'm going to say a bit more about what we mean by spiritual death, what it is, and why it's necessary. And I'm going to use the life story of the Buddha as an example of spiritual death, as an illustrated a story that illustrates spiritual death. And then finally, I'm going to look at how we can follow the Buddha's example, given that we don't live in the sort of in the same world that he lived in, and given that some of us have got all sorts of restraints and responsibilities which limit us. I mean, we can't do anything like what he did. So first of all, spiritual death, what is it? What is it? What do I mean when I say spiritual death, and why do we need it? Because it sounds pretty negative, doesn't it? Well, I mean, at one level, if we're going to look at the sort of highest level, spiritual death is about going beyond all our ideas of being a separate, isolated, limited self. It's going beyond our separate limited selfhood and becoming something much more universal. That's what we mean by spiritual death. At the highest level, enlightenment is a sort of spiritual death. It's a sort of dying to the old person, dying even as well as a rebirth. But we can also look at spiritual death, if you like, in a slightly less exalted way. That might be for a bit further along the path. So we can look at it in a slightly less exalted way that's maybe a bit more appropriate to where most of us are on our spiritual path. So the spiritual life is about transformation. It's about change. It's about one thing becoming something else. It's about change, transformation. And for transformation to happen, the old has to pass out of existence. To change, we have to let an old version of ourselves die. so that something new can come into existence. The old version of ourselves might be fine in many ways. It might be very workable. People might like it a lot. So even when the old self, the old identity, is by no means bad, if we really want the liberating and transforming effects of the Dharma, we've got to let it die. We've got to step beyond it. Step beyond that old self. Let the old self die. So we've all got an idea of ourselves. We've all got an idea of ourselves based on our conditioning, based on the sort of person we've been conditioned to be, and based on our past history. We've got certain experiences, and that's sort of formed an idea of ourselves. But this idea of ourselves that we carry around with us is not our real selves. Actually, we're much more than that. We've got loads more potential than that. So our idea of ourselves, based on this conditioned identity, is a prison. It's a prison that limits us. And we need to keep breaking out of that prison. Keep expanding our idea of who we could be, what we could be. And if we don't do that, if we don't keep breaking out of the spirit, the prison of our old selves, we will get stale and stuck. The colour and the joy will go, and the interest will eventually sort of drain out of life. So, at this level, if you like, spiritual, what we mean by spiritual death is leaving behind our old version of ourselves. Leaving behind our old image of ourselves, the old stories that we tell about ourselves that sort of makes ourselves up. So leaving the old self behind, breaking free from a prison that limits us, so that we can experience more of who we could be, who we could really be. So spiritual death is really a highly positive thing. And in fact, we need to keep dying, if you like, to an old version of ourselves, to keep growing. So it's highly positive. But it probably doesn't look like that at the time. Sounds nice and cozy, doesn't it? So it sounds sort of quite nice and cozy, sort of breaking out of an old identity, becoming something new. But the trouble is, our old self doesn't want to die. Our old self is, well, it's our self. It's who we are now. It's our present self, the person we are at the moment. So it sounds great to talk about spiritual death, but we don't want to die. Spiritual death sounds great. Spiritual death looks great when it happens to somebody else. But when it comes to us, spiritual death feels like, it feels like death. Because it is. In the words of the immortal Leonard Cohen, it looks like freedom, but it feels like death. It feels like something to be avoided. It feels like something to be avoided. To embrace it takes courage and it takes faith that there's something else beyond in the future. And often we don't embrace it. Actually, we're forced into it. But whether we embrace it or we're forced into it, spiritual death is something we need. It's something we need if we're going to grow. We need to break through our limited ideas of ourselves so that we can become something much more, so that we can become who we could be, so that we could become, in a sense, who we really are. Our true selves, who we've always been, but didn't know it. So, okay, that's a little bit in a general sense. Maybe let's be a bit more specific. What do we mean? Well, you know, what's the sort of things we've got to leave behind? What's the sort of things we've got to break through? So, a couple of weeks ago, we had a Buddha Day festival here, and the groups that Amoghavangsa and I were leading, I believe, I'm not sure. Yes. That's right, and Suryamati. We were looking at a text by Sangharakshita called Breaking Through into Buddhahood, which talks about this very question. And in this text, which is quite pokey, he says we need to break through everything that conditions us, everything that limits us. So we need to break through our sort of everything about our past. He says we need to break through our family conditioning. We tend to think of ourselves being a particular way because of our family background. We need to break through, he says, our psychological conditioning. So, you know, I'm afraid of this. Oh, it's a spider. I don't know. I feel comfortable with that. I'm afraid of this. You know, that gives me the heebie-jeebies. I can't do that. So we've been conditioned psychologically. We need to break through that psychological conditioning. We need to break through our conditioning due to our profession or our role in society. So not think of ourselves as a sort of successful administrator or a wealthy businessman or a doctor or a dustman or whatever, which very often we define ourselves by our role in society. We need to break out the limitations of that role. We need to break out of our class conditioning. Can be quite strong, actually, in a country, in an old, established country like the UK. People think of themselves very much in terms of where they've come from, in terms of their class or can do. I can do that. I can't do that. That's the sort of thing that people from a different class do. We need to break through, he says, our national and linguistic conditioning, which is incredibly strong, but most of us just completely unaware of it. You know, we may be English and we behave in an English way. We're noticeably different from Italians. We don't wave our arms all over the place and shout. But that's not because we're fundamentally different. That's just because we've been conditioned in a different way. I mean, I happen to have spent quite a lot of time in Spanish-speaking countries. And I really see this with myself. When I speak Spanish, I become a different person. This linguistic and national conditioning is not just something superficial, it's a way of being. It's a way of being. So when I speak Spanish, I use my voice differently. I use my body differently. I have a completely different body language. I use my voice differently. I think and I feel differently. So being English or being Spanish or Italian or whatever, it's an entire conditioned way of being. It's not just trivial stuff like whether you like Chianti or bitter. It's a whole way of being that comes along with a whole way of feeling and a way of relating to others, and way of responding to events. So we need to break through our national and linguistic conditioning. Quite a job. We need to break through our gender conditioning. And he says that ultimately we need to break through even thinking of ourselves as a human being, to become something much more universal. Maybe become the universe being conscious of itself rather than Joe Bloggs, the school teacher from Sharrow or whatever. You know, something much more universal. So, okay, maybe breaking through our idea of ourselves as human, maybe we'll leave that for the future. Maybe we'll leave that for the Mitra class or something. But at our level, okay, maybe it's okay to think of ourselves as human. We'll give ourselves that permission. But it's not really okay if we're trying to go to somehow to grow, to think we're somehow defined by being working class or middle class or upper middle class, or by being educated or being uneducated, or by being left wing or right wing, or by being a Guardian reader or a Telegraph reader. We're not defined by being a doctor or a social worker or a teacher. And really, people do get defined by all these things. We need to break out of thinking we're English or Scottish or American or whatever. We need, in a way, to break out of our whole past, free ourselves from it. Because in the past, we got scared of dogs and got scared, anxious in interviews, couldn't relate to Renaissance pictures and hated jazz. Does not mean that in the future we have to do any of those things. We don't need to be defined by our past. We shouldn't let the past define the person we're going to be in the future. So we need to break out of our past, let our old self die, continually transcend the limited person that the past has made us, and not get stuck in any outdated version of ourselves. So we need to die. We need to die to the old identity that the past has created, perhaps all the time, just be constantly stepping beyond it. I remember once being in a study group on, or a group on an order convention, and there was an order member called Parami there. And she introduced, we all introduced ourselves and said what our names meant. And she said, I am Parami, and my name means she who continually transcends herself. And I thought, yippee, a great name. But that's what we need to be doing, sort of continually transcending our old self, our old idea of ourselves. Leaving the past behind. So we need to do that continually, but sometimes maybe we also need to do it in a sort of decisive, radical, almost surgical way, where we cut away our past, cut ourselves away from our past. And a really good illustration of this actually is the life story of the Buddha. The life story of the Buddha is a cracking illustration. Once in a very big way, and several times in a somewhat smaller way, the Buddha completely dies to his old self. He's continually, in fact, leaving himself behind and breaking into new territory. So the really big example, if you like, concerns what is usually called the Buddha's going forth. Going forth. So a lot of us will know this story like the back of our hands, but I think it pays to think about it again and think about it a bit more deeply, see different sides of it from time to time. So I'm not going to apologize for telling it again. So most of us know that the Buddha was born into an aristocratic family in northern India, maybe 500 years before Christ. So in all the stories, the Buddha's father was a king. And the Buddha to be, if you like, was a prince. So he lived in a gorgeous palace set in beautiful grounds, and he always had the best of everything. The best and most gorgeous clothes, the best food, handsome and beautiful and charming companions, and so forth. And he was trained as a warrior. He was trained as a member of the Kshatriya class, the sort of aristocratic warrior caste. So he had a very clear social role. He might one day have to lead armies into battle, because he was a Kshatriya and the son of a king. But in the meantime, the payoff was he could lead a life of leisure and luxury and pleasure. So he had this clear social role. What he could be as a human being was strongly conditioned by his caste and his family and his position in society. This defined the person he was, the person he could be. So he had this social role. I mean, maybe he had a social role to die for, actually. Not a bad one. I mean, better than some I can think of. But it was still a limitation. If he was going to be that particular person, defined by that role, then defined by that circumstance, then he couldn't be anything more. So we're told that the Buddha's father was desperate to stop him becoming anything more than his social role, than what he'd been conditioned to be. So he gave him a very, very protected life. He tried to protect him from anything that would sort of rock his equilibrium. He tried to shield him from the truths about existence. But he couldn't shield him from reality. He couldn't actually succeed in shielding him from reality. And reality broke through into the Buddha's sheltered and privileged life in the form of what are usually called the four sights. So the four sights, what are the four sights? The Buddha, while being driven around the kingdom by his charioteer, he saw these four sights. He saw a sick person. He'd never seen anyone ill before. He just had these charming, beautiful companions. He saw somebody sick, fevered, sweating, ill, green-skinned, you know, all that, emaciated. And he said, what's going on? Who is this? And the charioteer said, well, he's ill. What do you mean he's ill? He's ill. What, does that happen often? Happens all the time. Happens to everybody. What? He was completely shocked. Ill? What does that mean? And then he saw an old person. A bit like me. Like, a bit more, worse, perhaps, you know. Even worse. And he said, what's happened to him? that's, does that happen to everybody? Yeah, it happens to everybody. That's amazing. And then he saw a dead person. He saw a body being carried to the cremation grounds. And again, he said, what's that? And the charioteer said, well, he's dead. What do you want? He's dead. Happens to everybody. Happened to you, happens to me. Going to happen to everybody. So he saw these are the three negative sights that he saw, which represented the existential realities, represented certain truths about the nature of our existence. A sick person, an old person, and a dead person. And then he saw a fourth sight as well, a fourth sight which was, if you like, the positive side. He saw a wandering holy man, completely fascinated by this wandering holy man. So the wandering holy man, if you like, represents the positive possibility of a creative response to the reality of our situation. So you've got the three negative sights representing reality, and the positives, the holy man, representing a creative response to that. So the three negative sights, if you like, they sent a message to the Buddha that basing his life on leisure and pleasure wasn't going to work as a solution to the reality of existence, the realities of existence. All the pleasure in the world wouldn't stop him getting sick, wouldn't stop him getting old, wouldn't stop him dying. And he would always have that truth at the back of his mind. Because he would always have that truth at the back of his mind, there would always be something a bit sad and pointless and maybe even childish about trying to find any sort of lasting fulfillment through these superficial passing pleasures. So that's the sort of sight, that's the sort of message, if you like, that the three negative sights sent to the Buddha. But then the fourth sight, the wandering holy man, sent a different sort of signal. It sent a signal that there is another way, that there is a solution to the nature of reality, to these apparently nasty facets of reality. And the solution is not to distract ourselves from reality with passing superficial pleasures. The solution is to grow as a spiritual being. To become the sort of person who can actually cope with reality. The solution is to develop spiritual vision, to develop emotional positivity, to develop inner riches, inner strength, so that we can live a really fulfilled, genuinely fulfilled life in the midst of reality, rather than running away from reality. So that's what the fourth sight represents, the possibility of a response to reality that really works, that isn't just plastering over the cracks and pretending they're not there. So these four sights, they deeply affected the Buddha, or the Buddha-to-be. His present life, good as it was, came to seem empty to him, came to seem pointless, even a bit childish. Endless round of feasts and dancing girls and whatever, archery competitions probably. And instead he longed to do something that had some real meaning to it. But he couldn't do that. He was completely constrained by his, if you like, his old self. He was this particular person in this particular circumstances. He couldn't do what he felt he needed to do and still keep his old social role. He couldn't live a spiritual life and satisfy the expectations of his father, his family, his clan, for him to be a prince. And as long as he was living a life of luxury, he was still going to be attached to his old habits. He would still be trapped in his old self. He'd still be attached to all of that and finding it very sticky and difficult to let go. So the Buddha realized, or the Buddha-to-be realized, that he needed a spiritual death. Represented, if you like, by the mendicant, the fourth sight, the holy man. So he went forth. As they say, he went forth from his old life. He went forth from his old self, his old identity. He took off his fine clothes, which were a badge of his identity as a prince. And he put on an old robe like a nobody, a vagabond. He cut off his long hair, which was another badge, a badge of his warrior status, a badge of his membership of the aristocratic Kshatriya clan. So he was a warrior. He cut off his long hair, sign of a warrior. So he did away with the badges of his old self. the old self that he'd been conditioned to be. He left behind his old identity, he left behind his palace, he left behind his family, and he went forth as an anonymous wanderer, a nobody. So from where we sit, 2,500 years later, with his image on our shrine, we can see that this was a really positive step, because we know what happened. We know what happened. But to his relatives and his clan and his family, it looked anything but positive. I mean, he'd left, okay, a conditioned identity, but he'd left an identity that most people would kill for, to become nothing, a nobody, a vagabond, beggar. This was spiritual death with a vengeance. The Buddha really went for it here. He didn't just sort of think, well, maybe I'll give up second helpings. It was like, limit the dancing girls to one session a day. No, I mean, he went for it. Give it all up, go forth as a nobody. He might as well have been dead. He became nothing in most people's eyes. He would have been nothing, just this guy on the road. But out of that nothing, something new could emerge, and something new and very wonderful did emerge, as we know. That can't happen unless the old dies, good as the old might be. So this is the well-known, this episode is the well-known going forth of the Buddha. And that this going forth has become formalized. And a lot in some Buddhist traditions, it's become formalized as becoming a monk or a nun. Leaving the home life, becoming a monastic. That's called going forth. It's a sort of modeled on the Buddha. You cut off your hair, you cut off your eyebrows, you cut off your beard if you've got one. You put aside your old clothes, you give away your possessions, you change your name. You leave behind all your old circumstances and you go and become somebody completely different, or maybe nobody completely different. You just sort of lost your identity in a way. So you become nobody at all. So that's sort of formalized in the Buddhist tradition as the sort of going, the going forth becomes formalized as becoming a monk or a nun. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work anymore, because monks and nuns have got quite a lot of status, and they might have really comfortable lives, and da da da, they don't have, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe we'll say a bit more about that in a little while. So anyway, but that's the going forth, the Buddha's going forth, the really big spiritual death, completely dying to an old, very attractive identity, and becoming a nobody, wandering the dusty roads of India. It might not be, but that wasn't the only going forth. That going forth from the royal life into homelessness wasn't the Buddha's only going forth. He became, if you like, a spiritual seeker. He looked for spiritual teachers, and he had a couple of meditation teachers. So he had a very, very well-known meditation teacher who was, he was really well-known at the time. One of the foremost meditation teachers of his day. And he mastered the techniques he was taught. He became very adept at the sort of style and type of meditation that was being taught, the spiritual path that was being taught. So much so that the teacher, the sort of guru, offered to share the leadership of the sect with the Buddha, He said, you're cracking, Stick with me, I'll see you good, You can follow in my footsteps, you'll be the main man after me. So the Buddha, if you like, the Buddha-to-be, became a real spiritual whiz kid. Of the sort who in our day might write lots of books about the Dharma with names like, what would they be called? Waking Up Together. Laptop Flim Flom, Laptop Fly Mate. Anyway, he'd write lots of books about the Dharma and charge loads of money for appearances, because it's such an honour to have him teach you meditation. He's got these snazzy techniques. So he's the sort of person who in our day could have made lots of money and fame out of the Dharma. He became that. This was another identity. This was another self. No longer a prince, now a spiritual whiz kid. Yay! spiritual superstar. Tempting. Lots of tempting stuff about being a spiritual superstar. Nearly as tempting as being a prince. But the Buddha saw through that. He went forth from that self as well. He said, he really sat back and he said, I don't think this technique that I've become so good at is the answer. I don't think it's going to get me anywhere. I'm leaving. Shock, horror. It's like the Pope saying, well, maybe you should become a Presbyterian. I don't know. It's like somebody who's got their identity invested in something, going back on it. Saying, no, that's not working. So he went forth from that identity as a spiritual superstar. He then actually did that again. He joined another school, became a whiz kid in that school, and went forth from that. And then he decided he was going to try what sounds very weird now, but was apparently quite a strong sort of tradition at the time. He was going to try ascetic practices. So there's quite a lot of people in India at the time who believed that you could free the spirit by weakening the body, or by, I don't know about weakening the body, you could develop a sort of strength of will to transcend your physical nature by extreme ascetic practices, like starving yourself, standing on one leg for days at a time on top of a pole, sitting between four fires. What else did they used to do? They used to do one of the most wacky things. And all this was believed that, you know, you're developing this really strong will, you're going to be able to transcend your physical nature. So the Buddha tried this. He became really good at it. Again, he became really good at it. He could eat less than anybody else, you know, and still stay alive. He could stand on one leg longer than anyone else. So he became very, and he got a following. He got a following. He got, you know, a lot of adulatory followers who thought, he's the main man. You know, he's really good. We'll follow him. He got lots of respect. He became, again, a different sort of spiritual superstar. And then he went forth from that too. He decided, he thought about it and he thought, it's not working. I'm just getting weak. It's not working. This isn't the way. Where's the nearest food? And the people who'd followed him, people who gave him so much respect, they all were completely disgusted. Oh, well, he's gone soft, you know. There he is, he's eating rice. Softy. So, again, he'd gone forth from an identity. He'd got what for many people would have been quite laudable identity, spiritual teacher, this hard man of the spiritual world. No, that's not working. I'm going forth from it. So, he went forth from that, and that took a lot of courage. We know it was going to pay off, actually, leaving these different spiritual schools, moving on. We know that was going to pay off. He didn't know it was going to pay off. He was moving away from something that he got a lot of himself invested in, where he could have been a big man, lots of respect, lots of following. But no, he moved on. It's a bit like, some mentioned the Pope. It's a bit like some Hindu guru with loads of Rolls Royces sort of appearing on the stage and saying, oh no, that's complete rubbish. I've just changed my mind, you know. I'm actually going to go and go to a beginner's class at the Sheffield Buddhist Centre, something like that. It's like, you know, I've got it wrong. I'm a big man in this, but I've got it wrong. I'm just going to go back to being square one. It takes a loads of courage. So the Buddha went forth from self after self. He went forth from identity after identity, never letting success or respect trap him into a worn-out self, a self that has sort of passed its sell-by date. Constantly moving on, constantly transcending himself, until eventually he reaped the rewards. Eventually he transcended himself completely and broke through into that completely different dimension of enlightenment. So we need to emulate the Buddha in this, as we do in many of our other practices. Like, you know, we emulate him doing the mindfulness of breathing. We need to emulate him also in constantly transcending our old versions of ourselves, leaving them behind. Keep becoming something newer and bigger. Keep moving the boundaries. Keep moving the frontier. We need this sort of gradual, continual spiritual death. But to do this, we may also need to copy the Buddha, sometimes at least, in his first going forth. We may need to do something to radically leave an old self behind, radically leave some old circumstances behind, radically free ourselves up to become something else. And okay, some of us have got a lot of constraints on us. Well, we don't live in the Buddha's time, for a start. You can't just go and live in a forest. Some of us have got a lot of constraints on us, and some of us have got a lot of responsibilities which limit our actions, and we have to take those into account. But there are, no doubt, folk here among us who could make a radical change. So some of us could go forth more than we do now, unquestionably. And some of us would gain from that. I offer you that as a suggestion that some of us might just gain from it. Why? Why do I make this tremendous claim? Well, apart from 2,500 years of British tradition, old places, old routines, familiar people tend to keep us the same. The Dharma, spiritual life, is about transformation. The same old places, the same old people, the same old routines tend to keep us the same. The old stuff, the same old stuff, tends to bring up the old, same old patterns, the same old mental states, and the same old responses. It doesn't leave us much room to be different very often. We can get locked into our life, a bit like a piece in a jigsaw puzzle gets locked into the puzzle. So like the piece in the puzzle, we can't change unless the other pieces change too. The other pieces leave us a particular shaped hole that we can exist in, which defines what we can be. And when life is like that, it can be a lot easier to step out of the puzzle than to try and persuade all the other pieces to change so that we've got a bit more room. So that's why sometimes we need to step out of that puzzle. We need to step out of what sort of keeps us in a particular shape, keeps us stuck in a particular shape. We need to give ourselves the freedom to be a completely different shape. Because it's usually too difficult to persuade all the other pieces to change. We don't have to enter a monastery to go forth from our old self. We can do it in all sorts of different ways. So, well, I'm going to slightly trepidatiously give you an example from my own life, actually, of a sort of a going forth. So if I go back to when I was in my mid-30s, I had become very much a particular sort of person. I was reasonably successful and prosperous, pretty pleased with myself, actually. I remember going to Buddhist classes, and I could never relate to this idea that dissatisfaction. I thought, no, it's just great. I was pretty pleased with myself. And I was pretty addicted to a particular lifestyle as well. I didn't like the lack of freedom, but I thought the idea of not having plenty of money sounded a bit... So I was pretty, yeah. I was unable to imagine anything else, really. And then, for some reason, I got a rush of blood to the head. And I was offered this opportunity to go and help build a retreat centre in Spain. And it seemed quite exciting. That was sort of quite, you know, sunny Spain, mountains, lovely, you know. So I gave up my job. I sold my house. I gave a lot of my stuff away. And went off to help build this retreat centre. And just to add then, so there's an element of spiritual death in that, which was pretty scary at the time, but just to add to the level of spiritual death, as I was travelling down through Spain in a beat old Volkswagen van, I was robbed of everything. So I arrived with no passport, no wallet, no cards or checkbook, no money, no spare clothes, no identity. So there's something quite mythic about that. In retrospect. At the time I just thought it was... at the time it might have looked like freedom, but it felt like death, I can tell you. a mythic going forth it might have been, but I did not appreciate it one bit. But looking back, it was actually the most liberating thing that had ever happened to me. The time I spent there in that project was the time in my life that I changed most, the most fruitful spiritual time in my life. Bloody terrifying, but really fruitful. So it was a sort of a going forth from an old identity. I left behind an identity that I really couldn't, by the time I got back, I couldn't relate to the person who I'd been when I left. I couldn't imagine being that way. I think I was incredibly lucky, because the sort of opportunity to leave the old world behind and spend some time doing intensive spiritual practice that also sounds sort of exciting and attractive rather than just sort of monastic and difficult, doesn't come your way perhaps all that often. So I think I was very, very lucky. But, I mean, how can we maybe get, you know, how can we now in the different, very different circumstances get some of that sort of opportunity? So I'm just going to sort of make some possible suggestions, throw out some suggestions of the sorts of things we can do to get a bit of going forth in our lives. To the extent, you know, within the constraints of our responsibilities. So for those who can, one suggestion that Sangharakshita comes up in going breaking through into Buddhahood is travel. This has been quite a big thing in the order at times. But I don't mean travel as a tourist, or I think even as a backpacker. I mean going and living in a foreign country. Without slotting into a bunch of expats who pretend that they're back in the homeland and eat fish and chips and drink tetleys. So why does that work? Well, I mean, for one thing, it actually lets us see our national and linguistic conditioning. We suddenly realise that all of this bunch are completely different. They do things completely differently. They think differently, they feel differently, they behave differently. And that surely isn't just because, well, they're not right, because they're not English. You know, in fact, they sometimes seem happier. So maybe there's something about the way I am, which is to do with my linguistic or national conditioning, which I could become aware of and work on. So it frees us up. It can help us to see our national and linguistic conditioning and free us up from that. But I think there's something else as well about going to a foreign country, because I think while we're in our own country, we're sort of, this is my experience, we sort of have an idea of where we fit in. So we fit in a particular way. We're a particular sort of person from a particular sort of background, class, education area. And we sort of find it quite difficult to do something that's right out of that box. But when we go to a new country, we're completely free. People don't see us in the same way. They don't put us in the same boxes at all. We're free to completely reinvent ourselves if we want, if we're in a new country. So I think it can be a pretty liberating experience if you can do it. Okay, not everybody can. Not everybody's in a situation to do that. Another suggestion is changing our living or working arrangements. So one possibility, change living arrangements. What about moving into a Buddhist community, if you can find one, and set one up. Community living challenges loads. Well, what does it do? It challenges loads of our assumptions about ourselves. It's really a practice in its own right. Suddenly, it challenges loads of our conditioning, I think, because we've got to sort of encompass other people in our lives in a sort of harmonious way. We can't just carry on sort of going with our likes and dislikes all the time. So it's quite a practice. Not that easy. Which is why, you know, there is this culture, if you like, in the FWBO of seeking to have these communities where people live together on that basis. It's a real practice which breaks through some of our conditioning. And then maybe, there's another possibility, is maybe try changing our work. So we can be very, very conditioned by to think of ourselves as a particular sort of person because of the type of work we do or our professional status or whatever. So some people, for example, do this by giving up a job to do what we call working in a team-based right livelihood.
Business enterprise.
That's a long word, isn't it? There's only one you're likely to come across, unless you move somewhere outside Sheffield, and that's our Evolution shop in Orchard Square. So what that means is working as part of a Buddhist team in a shop. And why is this challenging? Well, Evolution shops tend to have the most absurdly overqualified staff in the retail sector. So the number of times I have been on a retreat or somewhere and heard people say something like, why am I bloody working in a shop? I'm a university lecturer. Or why am I doing shop assistant work? I'm a psychology PhD. Or, so there we have it. These are people defining themselves by something to do with their educational or professional status. So doing something like working as a shop assistant challenges some of our social and our class conditioning in quite a serious way. Gets us out of being a doctor, a nurse, a lecturer, whatever. So it gives us a real chance to liberate ourselves from some of this quite powerful conditioning. I once came across a Mexican sort of pseudo-spiritual teacher whose main thing was sort of kicking people out of their identities. And he used to have some wonderful practices. One of his practices was, one of the things he particularly liked doing was telling his upper-class followers, those really prosperous upper-class Mexicans in this rather conservative society, to go and work in very low-status jobs. Or if they wouldn't want to leave their job, to spend their evenings or their weekends selling chewing gum in the traffic jams, which is one of the things people do in Mexico City, or wiping windscreens in the traffic jams and then asking for a bit of money, or just plain begging to get people out of the role that I am this high status person from this sort of establishment. Free them from their limited view of who they were, defining themselves in this way by some accident of social status. So we could try this. You might not get a place in the Evolution shop, but you could try being low status for a while. Or even just see how you feel when somebody asks you what you do. Just try saying, I'm unemployed. Or I'm a shop assistant. It's quite fun doing that. It's quite sort of, if you're a certain sort of person, it's quite challenging actually to do that. So freeze yourself. Well, you could try that in all sorts of ways. Or you could try doing something like this Mexican teacher was doing. What's the most challenging thing? What would be the most challenging thing for me? We'll talk about that a little bit later. Free yourselves from your ideas about... You could do it the other way as well. I've talked about people who've got ideas about their high status or their educational status or their professional status. But some of us, I suppose, have got the other problem. We think we haven't got status. Well, you could try throwing that one out of the window and applying for some really highly paid jobs and just see how you get on. Why not? Actually, this Mexican teacher used to do this exactly the same thing. He used to, the other way around, he'd get sort of people who hadn't been particularly successful and get them jobs in boardrooms and things like that, see how they got on. So those are a few ideas. And some of those, you mess around with livelihood. They're difficult if you've got too many constraints or responsibilities. But I'm going to come up with a last one that nobody has got any excuse for not doing. And this is go on retreat. Yeah? Go on retreat. So for those of you who don't know, this retreats are a sort of Buddhist habit. You have to sort of start, it's a bit like getting into smoking cigarettes or drinking beer. You don't like it at first. You have to sort of gradually develop the habit. We go on a weekend to start with, and then go on a week, and then go on a 2-week retreat. And what happens is you go away from your usual life, And you go and live usually in a beautiful place, in quite a structured lifestyle, with none of the things that you usually do to enjoy yourself. You got up at 6:30 in the morning, or maybe 7 if Vajratar is running it. No TV, no going down the pub, no nothing, no, you know. And just lots of meditation and some study and some nice people and going for walks in the country. And lo and behold, having taken all the things that you usually do to enjoy yourself out of your life, you find yourself having a whale of a time. And you find yourself just feeling really blissful. Or you do if you're me, anyway. Most of the time. So taking ourselves away from our old situation, putting ourselves in a completely new situation, like being on retreat, is a form of spiritual death. It's a form of going forth. It might only be a 2-week going forth, but it's a form of going forth. And I think I can guarantee that if you do it, you will experience a different you. You will find that some of the way you experience yourself, a lot of the way you normally experience yourself, is to do with the life you normally live. The people that you normally surround yourself with, the tasks you normally do, the places that you normally inhabit. That there's an awful lot of weight, momentum behind all of that. And if you take yourself out and put yourself somewhere different, you will experience a different version of you. I think that's most people's experience going on retreat. And the thing is that you can't know what I'm talking about until you do it. Yeah? It really does work. So go on retreat. Retreats are the way that we can all do some going forth. We can all do some going forth. We can all go forth from our old situation and put ourselves, do something that seems quite radical and quite different. It's like entering a monastic life for a period. We can all do that. So go on retreat. That would be an excellent way of, well, it's not exactly a spiritual death, but you're certainly experiencing the seeds of a new self. You'll experience the way out of. You'll find out things about yourself which you didn't know, and you'll find ways of being which can sort of gradually flower into a spiritual rebirth. So go on retreat.